All right. So I was going to talk about the internal structure of accreting neutron stars and how we might probe it. And so I'll start off with just a general introduction. So what, start off with the most basic, what are neutron stars? They're the endpoint of massive stellar evolution. You have a massive star. It's less than, say, 10 solar masses or so. It ends its life as a white dwarf, and more massive, the core collapses, becomes a supernova. You're left with a compact object. And the pressure support for the object comes from degenerate neutrons, which tells you that its radius is of order 10 kilometers. So, and its matter, therefore, under extreme conditions, is of order nuclear density. As far as astronomical sources go, there's sort of four ways you see them. They're rotation powered. You can also power with magnetic fields. That would be a magnetar, so decay of very strong magnetic fields in the crust. You can see them from accretion, that is, matter falls onto them, and that will include under that burning of said matter. And finally, you can see them just because they're intrinsically hot, either from birth or being reheated by accretion of matter. And I've bolded these two because I'm going to lump them together today. And they're also interesting as they might be a source of gravitational radiation, which is a subject that people here right now are interested in. And right now, it's a very good time to be studying these objects because our instruments flying, I guess not BepiSx anymore, but Chandra, Exyn, and Newton RXTE, are flying and provide lots of information on timing with XTE, and then also with very good spatial and spectral resolution with Chandra and Exyn and Newton, so that you can actually begin doing real, you can really study these objects and extract meaningful, you can make meaningful measurements that are good enough to actually constrain things with them. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about here is I want to say sort of a little more introduction about what can we learn from cooling neutron stars, why do we care. Then I'm going to take you on a, this is probably something that most people are at least somewhat familiar with, but I'll take you on a tour of the fate of accreted matter. So something falls on the surface, what happens, and talk about, so continuing past where it would normally burn and things are called X-ray bursts, and going further in all the way to the core. And then I'll talk about probes of the internal structure, and there's two things I want to highlight, and that is a recently discovered superburst. I'll explain what those are, and then thermal emission from soft X-ray transients. So it's kind of a fairly broad brush talk. Don't be too specific. Okay, so here's a current roster of cooling neutron stars. So time in years and surface temperature. And the points, of course, of the data, the tracks are cooling stars. You have a star, it's hot, you let it cool. It cools by neutrino emission until the surface temperature gets down below a million degrees or so, and then it's more or less just thermal emission from the surface. And the point is there's two types of cooling, slow, takes a long time to cool, and fast. And the difference is under slow neutrino cooling, and an example of this is modified IRCA, so it's basically a neutron going to proton and electron, you need a bystander particle to conserve both energy and momentum. And the number of particles here from the phase space arguments tells you it goes like temperature to the 8th power. And of course, if your proton fraction were high enough, or if you have some other particles present, you can go much faster, and you make the temperature dependence, it goes like 10 to the 6th, or sorry, temperature to the 6th power, but the prefactor is maybe a factor of 10 to the 5 larger, potentially, in front. Then there are caveats depending on whether the relevant particles are superfluid or not. So, in any case, if you were to have a direct process operating, the temperature would drop like a rock, and we should never see any of these objects. On the other hand, several of them are apparently cooler than the slow neutrino cooling curve. Now, this is not quite solid because there's a lot of dials here you can play with, including the surface composition and so forth. In surface composition, amount of superfluidity, but the argument that's been made recently by Yakovlev et al. And also Kemenker et al. Is that a natural way to explain this is that there's just a range of masses, and the higher ones have a higher central density and therefore are going to cool more rapidly. And so this is one representative calculation they did. They vary them, of course you have to tune your parameters so that you go from slow to fast over a range of about, say, 2/10 of a solar mass difference. But if that were true, that would naturally explain all these observations. That is, ones that are rather warm here, and also ones like this guy here, and also Vela that are rather cool. Okay. And so you know, the important thing here is what people like to do from these observations, extract what is the, not only what is the mode of neutrino emission, but what's the equation of state of matter at somewhat greater than nuclear density. And additionally then, as well, the cooling process all depends on processes in the crust, and so you'd like to learn a little bit about that. That's matter at less than nuclear density. So what is the structure of this beast? So talk about the core. On top of that is a crust. This is roughly to scale. That is, the thickness of the crust is about 1/10 of the radius, which is 10 kilometers, and the mass is maybe 1/100. And for an accretion object, there's an outer layer of hydrogen helium. It may be present on an isolated star as well. That's not as well known. And below that are ashes. I'll talk about that in a second. Then you have a core, crust, which is composed of nuclei and electrons. Eventually, you have nuclei, electrons, and free neutrons. And eventually, when you reach around nuclear density, you go into the core. And the interior of the core, then, at high densities, may contain exotic particles, such as pions. Okay. So let's move out now and ask, let's look at an accretion object. And now go, so we're starting, something falls on the surface, and let's follow it inwards. So there's a photosphere, so that's a hydrogen helium layer, and then an ocean and crust, and the pressure scale heights here, you go from centimeters of the photosphere to 100 meters, say, below where the hydrogen helium would burn, and densities from that of water to a billion times that of water in the outer layers, and then below this is, we on the next slide. And matter's flowing through down here with a speed that's just given by continuity. Okay, so you have an accretion rate, the velocity is, as density goes up, the velocity is going slower and slower. Okay? So matter is just falling on the surface and being compressed. So what happens, so now I applied time in seconds and temperature. So this is the time in seconds of Lagrangian element as it's accreted. There's a kink here where it would burn, where the hydrogen helium would burn, and you get out ashes that Hendrik and Lars and Andrew Cumming worked out. So if it actually bursts, you get things of mass number of water 100, quite heavier than iron. And those ashes, so after it burns, whether it's stably or unstably, it then continues to be compressed further, going inwards, and after years, perhaps we'll say a little more about this, any carbon present can ignite. That's unstable, that gives you a superburst. Yes? This? No, the kink, so the kink is due, there's a change in the conductivity there. So all of a sudden, you go to things a much higher charge and it becomes much more opaque. So I'll come back to that in a couple slides. Okay, so this is the outer layer. Material falls on the surface, it's compressed, the hydrogen helium burns, too heavy stuff, maybe a little bit of carbon present. That ignites later and burns, and then continues on in. And so now I'll say, highlight a recent calculation done by Hansel and Zunick. What happens afterwards? So you could imagine starting with iron, and that's what they did in 1990. And as it's compressed, the first thing to say is that the density is going higher and higher, and the electron Fermi energy is rising. When that gets on the order of MeV, you can induce electron captures. So first thing to say, come back to that in a second. The electron captures then, so you have, you know, some nucleus here, electron Fermi energy is higher, you capture an electron, it emits a neutrino, it may come into an excited state of the daughter nucleus and decay from there and release some heat. But most energy is spent to come out in the neutrino. So you start with iron, you capture an electron, and you continue to capture electrons until you reach neutron drip, when the electron Fermi energy gets to about 30 MeV. So then you now move, so this is neutron number, charge number, so now you move down like this. And eventually, the charge number gets so low that the zero-point motion of the ions can induce a reaction. So a normal thermonuclear reaction, the ions are hot, they're moving around, and when they get close enough, you can have a thermonuclear reaction. But if they're very dense, then the zero-point motion of the ions can induce a picnonuclear reaction, one driven by just the density. So there's a fusion reaction, and so it jumps up, and then continues down again, back up. So you make a heavier nucleus, twice A, twice C, then more decays back down again. Now, if you start with the RP process ashes, this is 106 palladium. So the RP process, the ashes that are made from unstable hydrogen helium burning live up here. Here's a representative starting point then. That follows the same chain. You have a lot more reactions. You release a lot more particles. What they found is that you actually sort of converge. That is, you get nuclei in the same range of charge and atomic number. And you also have then picking nuclear reactions. And the total heat release is about 1.1 to 1.5 MeV per accreted nucleon, 1.5 being in the case of iron, 1.1 being in the case if the ashes are RP in a calculation. That's a substantial source of heating in the crust. Okay. So that's the first thing is, so there's a heat source in the crust, the accreting star. Second thing is we need to say what the conduction is, because eventually we're going to put this together and look at the temperature structure. So the thermal conductivity is just, you have electrons carrying the heat, each one carries KT. The other K goes on to the thermal gradient. This is the roughly the Fermi energy divided by C squared, and there's some relaxation time for if you perturb your electron distribution. So possibilities are, if it's just a pure lattice, you'd say it's phonon scattering. Otherwise, you could say it's impurity scattering. Excuse me. And the thing about this is, this looks like your sigma V for a liquid. That is, there's no correlations between ions, but instead of a charge, you have a RMS difference of the charge. So the electron, in some sense, knows that it's in the lattice. But then, if you have you replace one of the nuclei in the lattice with something else, what it knows is that there's a charge difference. There's something there that's different from what is normally there. Okay. And if this impurity scattering is large enough, it dominates. You can see that at low temperatures, the conductivity gets very high. So what limits your heat transport is the impurity scattering if this is large enough. And so coming back to Phil's question, then the kink in the slope there is that there's basically a z squared over the atomic number. So if you go from hydrogen to something much heavier, then it's much more opaque. Okay. Only that kink there, you also have some radiative transport on the crust. Okay. And okay, so now I'm going to just solve the equations for a steady state crust. I just have hydrostatic balance, equation for the potential, equation for the luminosity and the temperature. And the thing here is that I've got a heat source in the crust. If I didn't have this, then I just am carrying basically a temperature gradient between the surface layer and the core. And so if I didn't have that heat term, what would I have? Well, that's been done. So here's from a paper. There are many papers on this, but this is a representative one from Fujimoto et al., where they have, this is the density here and temperature. So material is arriving on the surface, accreting, being hotter and hotter. It burns unstably here. And then the crust is isothermal. There's no heat in it. This rise in temperature here is just in the core, in the gravitational redshift, but the core is isothermal. And we've got some heat flux that's being carried in the crust and being radiated out of the core. And of course, if you have an enhanced, very rapid neutrino emission here, then the temperature here is not too different. It's set by processes in the surface, but you're carrying a flux inward to the deep crust. Here's where you release neutrons. There's nuclear density, roughly. And the interior is quite cold. All right, so now let's imagine you have steady state rapid accretion. So I have crust reactions heat the core at a given, so there's a heating luminosity. And the way to understand this plot then is, so I have pressure here in units of MeV per cubic Fermi. So the core is here. So the material is accreting, it's going inward like this, higher pressure. And assume steady state burning here, and I've got low conductivity versus the high conductivity of a pure lattice versus something very impure. So the first way to understand it is you send all the heat you generate in the crust into the core, and it's re-radiated as neutrinos. So that sets your core temperature. But then you've got to carry some flux up to where all those nuclear reactions occur in the crust, so that's such a temperature gradient. And then, of course, you have a small amount of flux coming out, and it's actually very little at high accretion rates. I'm burning about an MeV, and about 5% of that comes out the top. So it's not terribly interesting, for instance, for normal type 1 X-ray bursts, because it's dwarfed by the nuclear burning at the surface. Okay. So now, they go ahead and say, now what effect can this deep heating have? And the first one are superbursts. So let me tell you what a superburst is. This is a superburst here. Now you notice the time scale here, this is days. So this looks, if you scaled this time scale down to seconds, this would look like a type 1 X-ray burst that's unstable burning of hydrogen and helium. But the time scale here now is hours. And the energy is, the energetics are much higher. It's more like 10 to the 42 ergs instead of, say, 10 to the 39 ergs, so a factor of 1,000 more. And the fuel for this is, for most of these objects, is probably a combination of burning of a small amount of carbon ignition, I was shown by Andrew Cumming and Lars, and photodisintegration of heavy nuclei, and Hendrik Schatz recently demonstrated. If the object were accreting, and if you have very rich carbon ignition, you can do that as well. But for most of these objects that accrete hydrogen and helium, there's probably not much carbon there, and this is the most likely, I think, case. So you have a small amount of carbon in these heavy ashes, and that ignites unstably. It gives you this large burst. And there is one recurrence time, so there's like 7 bursts seen from 6 sources, so one object seen to recur with a 5-year recurrence time, and that's an interesting number. So the fact that the duration of the burst is 1,000 times longer than that of a normal X-ray burst, the fact the energetics are 1,000 times larger, the recurrence time is also like 1,000 times longer, suggested this is burning at a much greater depth. And one thing is, why wasn't this known before? Well, there were estimates done of pure carbon ignition, and you get out a huge amount of energy on a scale of decades to 100 years. If you accrete very rapidly, you get out somewhat less, and you can do it on a rather short time scale. So this plot here is for pure helium burning, accretion rate going up. And this is where the burning balances the cooling. It's not balanced by neutrino. So the carbon burning isn't balanced by neutrino cooling. So it's different than like in massive stars. There's ignition, you have to get extremely, but the point is this thing here, where you burn, lives at a very high temperature, so unless you compress it very rapidly, or you wait for a long time to get down to where the reaction is strongly screened, you have to accrete rapidly to get a short time scale, or else you have to wait a long time in case you have a very large bomb. Okay. So what I haven't shown here is that what Andrew and Lars showed is that you can actually go at a much lower depth if you use the fact that you have very heavy ashes and you have a heat flux coming out from the core. And that's what I want to explore a little bit further now. So to do this, there's various ways of modeling the core. One is to actually use an equation of state and try to calculate everything self-consistently. That is, take best estimates of superfluidity and neutrino emission. The problem there is that you're limited in that you're doing things self-consistently, but you can't really explore the parameters. You're wedded to that model. So a nice paper came out recently, which is based on it's known that if you have this equation of state, you can solve the core structure analytically, and it gives you a very nice parameterized model. So it's just quadratic and radius. So this goes back to Tolman, 1939, and then Latimer and Prakash used it and demonstrated that actually this equation of state looks reasonable compared to nuclear physics equations of state, that is, things based on nucleon-nucleon scattering. So then Yakovlev et al. Took it and said, we're going to build a very simple toy model of a core to survey parameter space. And you have two modes of neutrino emission. You just have a slow one that goes like temperature to the 8th power, and a fast parameter that goes like, temperature to the 6th power. So once you set redshift in your radius, Then you can vary the mass for given, once you pick these values here, you can just vary the mass, and that sweeps through the central density, and you go from slow neutrino cooling to fast neutrino cooling. And then you can just interpolate between the two. And so if you use that, you can actually reproduce that plot of cooling neutron stars that I showed. Okay. So now let me redo the calculation that Andrew and Lars did. So carbon mass fraction of 10%. And the red triangles here is where heating equals cooling. So I haven't asked whether it actually, so here I'm not asking too much about stability, I'm just saying where is the burning equal cooling. And I've got several cases here. So two things, two shaded bands. This is for my impurity parameter of order 100. So RMS difference in the nuclear charge of order 100. So I'm assuming it's dominated by impurity scattering. There. These up here, I've assumed that it's just, I just take the charge of the nucleus. That is, I say there's no structure in the ions whatsoever. It's as if they're in liquid state. So I ignore any crystallization. And then here, I have, so these two things end here. That's slow neutrino cooling. The temperature is above 4 by 10 to the 8 Kelvin. And then down here, it's below 10 to the 8 Kelvin. That's if I have fast neutrino cooling, like a direct ERCA. Okay. So let's look at these cases here. The first thing to say is that, so this is a rather high accretion rates near Eddington. The first thing to note is that they sort of converge, and that's very easy to understand. If the rise in temperature is very large, and it doesn't matter what the temperature out here is. The relative rise is not that much, and you still have a little bit of flux coming out. The curvature down here is because there's an actual neutrino emission in the crust. They're quite hot. Okay, so this is just duplicating what I showed several slides ago. If you have very steady rapid accretion, everything goes in, there's a small amount coming out, and you have some rise in temperature, and that's what sets it. As you become more conductive, though, things split because now your temperature gradient is more shallow. So for this case here, the delta T is much less, and therefore it's much cooler, and the recurrence time here is much longer for the ignition. And I go from like 1 to 10 years in recurrence time. Okay. Let me now go to a lower accretion rate, which is actually closer to where most of the superbursts have been observed, and that's like a third Eddington. Here there's a much more pronounced difference. Again, the shaded regions are the same, so impurity parameter of 100, and here I'm just taking it to be a pure liquid, and then slow and fast neutrino emission. Again, here I bunch up between like so sort of 10-year recurrence time. But if I have a crust that is either, you know, an ideal lattice or one that's even impurity, you know, even an RMS difference in Z of order 100, the recurrence time gets to be of order 100 years if it's enhanced neutrino cooling. So I think if you see a superburst at all, now, you know, differentiating between here and here, you'd have to get the accretion, you'd have to know the accretion rate. It's rather sensitive. But I think you can say that the fact that we see them would tend to argue that the crust, the conductivity in the crust is much lower than people usually calculate, or that it's that's slow neutrino cooling. And now I'll just go to push the button too hard. Go back, and if you go down to a much lower accretion rate, this recurrence time now goes into the centuries, even for a case where it's very low conductivity. Okay, so just state that again. So we see superbursts, the one has a recurrence time of order 5 years, and that would tend to suggest then that either slow neutrino cooling or that the crust is basically, there's no order in the ions. I'll come back to that, why it's important at the end. What is the other place in which we might observe the effects of this deep crustal heating, and that is the soft X-ray transients. So this is a light curve of Aquila X1 taken with XTE, and And so you see what happens here is that it's got periods of outbursts that last of order a month, quiescent intervals that last of order a year. And you know, sort of the definition here is that you just have this large luminosity contrast of order, maybe 1,000 or more. And it's presumed to come from a disk instability maybe similar to dwarf novae. And I'm not going to say, they just blow up all these outbursts here. I'm not going to say too much about what causes them. I'm going to look at their effects. So the simplest thing to do that Lars and I and Bob Rutledge did a long time ago now is just conserve energy. So you heat the core at some rate.
We still conserve energy.
Huh?
Yeah.
We still conserve energy now, yeah. But that's true. Okay, so the reaction is heating the core at some rate, and you just want to balance it. So in quiescence, all that heat that goes in has to come out. And as you compare that with the gravitational binding energy, and then that just says that the quiescent flux, so it's gone from luminosity, but since the accretion rate here goes like the luminosity, I just divide out the distance. And the quiescent flux goes like the time-averaged outburst flux times the ratio of the heat release in the crust, the gravitational energy release. And there's no neutrino cooling here yet. So Bob Rutledge and I have been trying to scour every place we could find for the observations. This is what we're currently up to. This should really say in preparation. It will come out one of these days. But the filled points are black holes, open points are neutron stars. A downward pointing arrow means upper limit on emission. Rightward pointing arrow means there's only one outburst, which I take to mean that that's an upper limit on the accretion rate. It's really not, but the error bar in any case would be biased to that direction. So I have mean outburst flux here and the quiescent flux, and this is just that relationship here. I'll clean up this plot shortly and focus on the neutron stars. One interesting point about this is that most of the black holes are arrowed. They have one or two arrows. And if you go through and ask how many have a more than one outburst and not an upper limit, there are one, two, three objects. That's it. So people are trying to make it. So I'm a little bit skeptical now of any claims between trying to compare black holes and neutron stars. It really rests on three objects. That's an aside. Okay, so now we'll go into the case of just the accreting neutron stars. Here's the relationship again, mean outburst flux, quiescent flux. I've suppressed any points that have just upper limits. I mean, there's one point that's way up here. But the upper limit's not very good. In fact, the upper limit is worse than the mean outburst. Its quiescent upper limit is higher than its outburst flux. So there are a handful of points. They tend to lie systematically below this line here. So either the amount of heat release in the crust is less, it might also be due to the presence of neutrino cooling. And there are a few samples here, so this object here has had one very long outburst that was on for a decade, and it's just recently shut off. Likewise, Cenex 4 has only had one significant outburst. It's had two outbursts, but one was 1,000 times more energetic than the other. Okay. So in addition to that, but if we actually know the surface temperature, then we can play the game that are cooling neutron stars. We can actually integrate in, from the surface, the temperature, and actually measure the interior temperature of the object. This is work I did with Lars and Phil. And this is very simple to do, and we've done for three different things here. This is helium out here, then iron, pure ruthenium, and then this RP process mix. And so very impure crust. And you see that tends to make a difference. At low temperatures, the fact that it's impure makes quite a difference. The two pure cases, iron and ruthenium, you see there they tend to converge. On the last solution, doesn't really care what the composition is. Whereas the fact that you have a large mixture of species tends to make the gradient much larger. This is for the SACS 1808 object. it's the dimmest transient we have. And it's NX1 and Aquila-X1. And I can try to connect these on. So the kink there, I always put the slide in. The kink there is just changing conductivity. So we can try to connect into the interior temperatures for Aquila-X1. And what I'm ignoring here is the fact that I'm assuming the outburst is small enough that the crust doesn't cool appreciably. And that's true for Aquila-X1. It's not as true for SEN-X4. And so better calculation is done by Greg Ushomirsky and Bob Rutledge. But this is fairly close to give you an idea. For Aquila-X1, if I connect onto the core, I can't have a fast neutrino cooling solution, because in order to connect it, I wouldn't be able to have the flux coming out. I wouldn't be able to match the flux coming out. I wouldn't be able to do it self-consistently. For Aquila-X1, I really need to have a hot interior. I can't have a large gradient here because I'm not releasing that much heat. For SEN-X4, similarly, I have to have a much colder core. So it's been suggested from SEN-X4 that that's evidence that it's got a faster neutrino cooling. The second piece of evidence, Okay, so for 1731, this object had an outburst that lasted a decade, and in that case, then the crust is strongly perturbed. Okay, so the amount of heat release makes the crust temperature deviates strongly from its steady state value. So Greg Ushomirsky did a calculation of different cooling tracks of the crust. And for four cases, so you have low conductivity, standard cooling, low conductivity enhanced cooling, high conductivity standard cooling, and then high conductivity enhanced cooling. So you can see the difference. Basically, you end up at a different temperature in the end, whether you're slow or fast, and the rate at which you get there is determined by the conductivity. And so now, if you normalize to when the first observation was taken, and then follow it in time, the low conductivity, there's a long diffusion time. The thermal diffusion time of the crust is quite long, whereas for high conductivity, it's much quicker. And there is one observation that Rudy Vanens took about a year after the outburst, and the temperature dropped significantly. So if the two calculations are really just thermal emission from the star, that tends to favor enhanced neutrino emission and high conductivity. The problem, though, is that this source also shows a superburst, which would tend to argue the opposite. So, so now we put all the neutron star transients together on the same plot. And now I've had to put neutrino cooling in, and that introduces a temperature scale, and hence I can't make a distance-independent plot. So now I've put here mean accretion rate, outburst accretion rate, and the quiescent luminosity. And I've eliminated all points that have either only one outburst or an upper limit. So this is the five good points that we have. And they tend to favor slow neutrino cooling, although the error bars are large enough for a few of these to accommodate the fast, more enhanced case. And B and C here, the reason it's blue is that it's not a bolometric spectrum, it's just what's in the X-ray band. So you might expect that they're systematically brighter when you include the luminosity that's below a tenth of a keV. And this source here is the most, it's not bolometric, and the spectrum is not really well taken. So if you move it upward by a factor of two or so, which is reasonable for the bolometric correction, it may also agree with the slow neutrino cooling. So the state of it is from these objects that there's no need, at least from the transients, to have an enhanced neutrino emission, with the exception that the one object for which we seem to see the crust thermally relaxing is relaxing too fast, so you need a high conductivity and enhanced neutrino emission. Okay. So in a little bit of time, I've gone way too fast, so. Please ask. So please, you have to ask me and make me explain all the things I went by through. I went flying by. Anyway, summary. So there's all these reactions in the crust of the neutron star that heat it when it's accreting. That heat is observed from neutron star transients, and it affects the recurrence time of superbursts. So if you know the accretion rate accurately, which is difficult, but if you can get that accurately, then you can start. You can ask. You know. Then you say that says something about the interior of the crust. Why do we care about all this? Why do we care about gaining the connectivity? So first, you can compare. You can now enlarge your sample of isolated neutron stars. There's a lot more accreting neutron stars that are observed than there are isolated cooling ones. Secondly, if you want to do magnetic field evolution, like study, so you want to say, do accreting neutron stars become millisecond pulsars, which have fields that are 10 to the 4 times less than ordinary pulsars? If you want to understand the magnetic field evolution, you need to get the dissipation in the crust. And that is related to the thermal conductivity. It also depends a little bit on the damping of stellar modes, which is important for gravitational radiation. You'd like to know what's present in the core. That sets the viscosity. And of course, if you are dissipating in the core, then the neutron star is a calorimeter. And then that heating is also comes into these here. That was something that Greg and I did a few years ago, and Bob Wagner, I think, has recently revisited. Okay, so I flew through that, so please ask me lots of questions. Phil.
Is there anything like basic physics that constrains what the cross sample you get out for a young pulse from magnetized out here?
Well,
we don't have RP here.
No. So for young object, you get very hot, and so the idea is that you would go into the nucleus that's at that equilibrium for that pressure. So, and in yeah, and also whatever, I mean, there's a favor for a given density, there's a favored A and Z. There's a minimum, there's a binding there. You go to the maximum, the most bound nucleus at that density. So that is what has been assumed when people calculate. So all the stuff about the cooling objects, that's what's assumed. That gives you iron to the surface, for instance. So the first surface layer is, first of all, we know there's fallback of some type. Well, I don't know that, but I think it's assumed. So that probably does give you a light some light elements at the surface. In the interior, there's been arguments. I think Jones had a paper on this, someone else whose name I can't remember, that argued there'd be a natural, there'd be some fluctuations about. So you have an equilibrium nucleus at a given pressure. There's some fluctuations about that in composition. Now, I don't think there's anybody that's done like a supernovae calculation and actually followed and said, here's the composition in time-dependent fashion. So.
The accretion
rate for the
superbursts, is that just related to being able to learn
accretion stability, or are they able to learn accretion? So you're asking why are superbursts not seeing higher accretion rates?
Yeah.
So Andrew and Lars pointed out that the luminosity contrast of the burst, so at high accretion rates, it's very deep, and the luminosity contrast of the burst is much less than. So at low accretion rates, the accretion luminosity is lower, so it's much easier to spot. It may just be observational. But I don't know how well the archives of observations have been searched. I don't know if that's, not well enough.
Well, Midwest Sachs would have a hard time.
Yeah.
Just the way the telescope's run. But XTE, you see a little bump. I mean, they have high signal to noise data, so you'd be able to see a 10% change, no problem. Midwest Sachs can't detect the 10%. Superbursts, they solve for factors of 10 contrast.
Yeah. I guess the question is, so is anyone, no one's put a meaningful constraint on the observations of the statistics? Okay. Okay. That's too bad.
Yeah, the number sex is in the ocean, so nobody's paying right.
Anything. Yeah.
So it's in the, yeah, there's archival data, someone could do
it. Yeah. Yeah. That would be nice. You could actually map out all this. Yeah. So yeah, 5 years. No. No. So, you know, things you could do with this is for the future. There's nothing that can really be done now other than just speaking in generalities about it, I think.
But for the 5 other sources, how long have they been observed? Their outbursts were how long ago, maximally?
Oh, so they're all within the past 5 years? But I guess the relevant question to ask is what's the duty cycle? And so I remember Eric Kolkers was looking at this and tried to estimate what the statistics are. I think the problem is it's hard to really extract, you know, just, you know, how often would you have expected to cat, you know, how often were you staring and all that? You have to go through.
Just curious as to the next 5 years.
If one accretion rate is regular enough, it would be helpful that was on that water. But you know, the recurrence time is very sensitive to the accretion rate. So secular variations in the accretion rate, you can make wild swings. I guess the other thing I should have mentioned is that the other resolution to recurrence time is that there may just be additional nuclear burning between where the hydrogen helium burns and the superburst occurs. So the ash generation that was calculated is always, you know, so what's ongoing now is a project to actually do the time-dependent evolution of the accretion, so actually have a stellar model and follow the burning and for many, many bursts and build up, and hopefully build up some kind of limit cycle and say what the ashes are in that case. And I think there's some suggestion from Stan's group and also Friedel-Tillman's group that's different than if you just have one, you know, you have one burst, but then if you have many, the ash composition is different. And it is true that if you put in actually the ash composition from the one zone and you try to make an X-ray burst, what happens is the ashes ignite. So, maybe additional physics there.
What's the current thinking on hyperon cooling?
Good. I was hoping someone would ask. So at the central densities you reach, you are at a place where they should be present. So oddly enough, they should give a cooling similar to the direct IRCA. So I think Bob Wagner wants that they don't have too high a superfluid transition temperature because he needs them to be present. But if that's the case, then...
Well, even if they do go superfluid, there's still a shell.
That's right.
At the boundary, if
that's right.
Density goes to zero, or you get around meters thick of that screen.
You get something, right.
Cooling.
Right.
You still have a conductivity to feed the heat into that layer. And
that's right. So...
I mean, can you put constraints on how much of that... there
could
be from this kind of observation?
So, yes, I haven't.
I haven't done it yet. So.
I want to revisit it. So, the calculation, did I put it in here? I don't think I put it in here. So, Greg and I had done a calculation for modified IRCA looking at if you damped, if you have a mode and you want to damp it, so it's the rotation of the star is in steady state. So, there's a torque from accretion and you have to damp it from gravitational radiation from a mode. So then you say, fine, the star is basically a calorimeter. Would that show up in the plots of the transients, which are here? Yeah. And in that case, for modified IRCA, it puts this curve up here. And so we argued that you weren't going to see it. But so my understanding now is that the viscosity due to hyperons would work. You could get a steady state R mode. And if that's the case, and there's a region where they are, you know, there's some, at least some fraction of them are not superfluid, then you've got two effects: that you've got now enhanced neutrino emission, and you've got extra heating. And so, what I have to do when I get back from here is actually calculate this curve with that in and see what happens.
But I guess maybe the other way to ask these questions, or maybe ask it again, is I mean, can you just forget R modes?
Yeah.
Can you just constrain from the fact that you know something about these systems?
Oh, whether they're present or not at all.
Whether hyperons are present or not.
Well. So, you know, if they had a direct cooling, they'd be more down like this, and these systems are hotter, unless they're superfluid. So that's the problem, you're always playing one off against the other. If you say that where they are present, you know, if the shell it emits is small enough, then you could tolerate these systems within their error bars, I think, right? And also, for the superbursts, there's not a problem with that at the current accretion rates if the crust is very impure.
Yeah, the shell is very thin, though.
Yeah, I know. It has.
It's so efficient.
Yeah.
It just doesn't matter. You just have, it's a really cold shell, and the conductivity of the core is very high, so it just sucks everybody down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then maybe it seems like that's the way, that's what he's asking.
Yeah.
Those data, you could. I mean, I don't see how you can make those data consistent if there's hyper on core. You say that.
Well.
Prove it.
Yeah. I mean, these two points would be awfully hard to explain, yeah. But if there is cooling and it is offset. But so this way, if there's no viscous heating from a mode,
just
yes.
Forget our modes.
Yeah.
Just imagine for Aquila X1.
Yeah.
Want to understand Aquila X1 and frequent outbursts, you know the rate of heating pretty well. You know
right, but that's what I'm saying. If there is viscous damage from R mode,
sure.
Then I maybe could explain it because that would I'd have to have the two effects counterbalance one another. If there's no viscous heating, then it's pretty tough.
Because I mean, point E is the point for which you know the most about.
That's correct.
The best study system.
That's right.
And you didn't, I presume, put the red line through point E intentionally.
No, that is completely coincidental. Believe it or not, I would never do something like that.
You do need a little bit of neutrino for that guy. Right?
Yeah. Well, it fits naturally. If you don't, so you know, what's this part down here is where there's no neutrino cooling operating, it's just radiative.
Right.
So you get a sort of natural fit like that, but remember that's, you know, the nuclear heating, the crust is perhaps uncertain,
sure.
By 50%.
But if you put in hydrocool at that point.
This point goes down to here, and then it's whatever. So now I have to have something kind of.
Your core connectivity is screwed up by other super.
Well, that's the bane of all this. Is you can always put another dial in.
It goes right through the data point. That should have some meaning in the sense of
why he was fine.
No.
Well, I mean, it is true. I mean, what would really be nice is the sources down here to know better. It'd be nice to fill this in a little bit because these are all at sort of, you know, they're all at you know, similar accretion rates. So if we could fill this in, it would be nice to see.
The whole hyperon issue is really interesting. It's hard to imagine from the nuclear physics that they're not there.
Yeah.
And they really do have a big effect on cooling, at least as we understand.
Yeah, no, it's certainly true if you take an equation state that's based on experimental nuclear physics, construct a neutron star model, and look at the central densities, then you know it's not self-consistent. The central densities are high enough that you have to include them. So, yeah. Which one? Yeah, I can do that. There you go.
Now, one of the guys, it's sort of weird, right? That initial point where you only
here?
Have an upper limit for?
Yeah.
Like how well studied is that? Like how seriously should I take that data?
How seriously?
Yeah, I mean, if I remember the paper,
yeah, this is the one that was recently.
It was modeled with just a little black body fit to the atmosphere. So I know for all systems at that age range, I mean, you I'm wrong with push down the effective temperature even further.
Right, that's what we did by body. So
yeah.
That's an upper limit.
Oh, that's an upper limit.
Yeah.
It's not a measurement, it's an upper limit.
So, okay.
So I think I don't have any reason to think that the upper limit is going to turn into a data point. I think that is solid. It's somewhat less than that.
Yeah, I mean, despite the fact that that result was in the same press release as the Warp Star, I think it's actually a good result.
Yeah. Well, you know.
But they shared the stage.
Yeah, it's.
Is there something funny that happens at roughly 1.4 solar masses where you have this huge variation?
That is their claim, is that one way to explain this is just to say they all have the same equation state, same physics, and the central densities at round 1.4 is sweeping through the transition.
I see.
Okay. That's their claim.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's assumed, right? They've chosen their parameters there to give that set of curves, right? I mean, you could imagine saying the density transition is low and everything is above it, and then nothing would fit, right? I mean, it is. I think, you know, the 1.4. I mean, and you know, around, and they're picking around 1.4. Or they picked a range of central densities for a given equation of state to do this. I mean, there is arguments that so the recently discovered object of the redshift tends to favor a stiffer equation of state. Certainly, all the nuclear equations of state tend to produce things with, you know, around 1.4 that give it reasonable values. For the objects that are in binaries, they all have an amazingly tight distribution around 1.4 solar masses. So that's why that's picked. Does that answer your question?
No.
Okay.
Great. Well, is that good?
Okay.